You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
You don't have authority to arrest U.S. citizens.
Sir,
you don't have the authority to arrest U.S. citizens. I'm not obstructing. I'm standing right here in the hallway. I asked to see the judicial warrant.
Hi, I'm the controller's press secretary. Where are you taking the controller of the New York, the city of New York?
ICE agents arrest another public official, this time at immigration court here in New York. City Controller Brad Lander was attempting to escort a migrant out of the building at the time. Lander will join us in studio. But first, dangers of a widening war in the Middle East. The U.S. appears on the edge of entering the Israel-Iran conflict.
The majority of those harmed in these past few days, if we look at the proportion, are women and children. These are all war crimes. They must be documented, and those responsible, their supporters, and those who justify these actions must be held accountable. In my opinion, worse than committing a crime or atrocity is justifying the crime.
And as Israel's attack on Iran overshadows its assault on Gaza, we'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha on the deepening crisis. Civilians in Gaza have repeatedly been killed while attempting to access aid.
We went to wait like other people to get food for our children. We have not seen food or drinks for 6 months. We went to wait like other people. They told us there's flour in a certain area, so we went and waited. Then we found rockets falling on us, missiles falling on us, and the quadcopter falling on us.
That and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has warned any U.S. military action in Iran will be, quote, met with irreparable harm. Khamenei's warning comes a day after President Trump demanded Iran's unconditional surrender. Trump also directly threatened Khamenei by writing on Truth Social, the U.S. knows exactly where he is, adding, quote, we are not going to take him out, at least not for now, unquote. Multiple reports indicate Trump is moving closer to ordering U.S. airstrikes on Iran after months of supporting negotiations. On Tuesday, Trump, after leaving the G7 summit early, dismissed findings by his own intelligence agencies on Iran. In March, the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, told lawmakers the intelligence community, quote, continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, unquote. On Tuesday, Trump dismissed Gabbard's testimony, saying, quote, I don't care what she said, unquote. This all comes as Israel continues to attack Iran for a sixth day, forcing thousands of people to flee Tehran. More than 50 Israeli warplanes struck targets inside Iran in the early hours of today. Iran responded by firing ballistic missiles and launching drones at Israel. According to one count, Israeli strikes since Friday have killed at least 585 people across Iran and wounded over 1,300. Iranian strikes on Israel have killed at least 23 people and injured more than 630. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine called on his colleagues to support his war powers resolution to prevent a U.S. war with Iran.
I happen to believe that the United States engaging in a war against Iran, a third war in the Middle East since 2001, would be a catastrophic blunder for this country.
Meanwhile, there's a growing split within Trump's MAGA coalition over the prospect of a U.S. attack on Iran. Conservative TV host Tucker Carlson has railed against what he calls warmongers within the Republican Party. On Tuesday, video went viral of him interviewing the hawkish Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
If you don't know anything about the country—
I didn't say I don't know anything about
the country. What's the ethnic mix of Iran?
they are Persians and predominantly Shia. Okay,
you don't know anything about Iran. So
I am not the Tucker Carlson expert on Iran.
You're a senator who's calling for the overthrow of the government.
You're the one
who
claims
anything about the country.
In Gaza, the death toll from an Israeli attack on aid seekers in Khan Yunis on Tuesday has reached 70. Hundreds of Palestinians were also wounded after Israeli forces used tanks, drones, and machine guns to fire on crowds who'd gathered hoping to receive bags of flour. The Nasser Medical Complex was overwhelmed with victims. This is Dr. Mark Brunner, a doctor from Oregon who's volunteering at Nasser Medical Complex.
Every time we know that there's a few so-called food distribution, we know that there's going to be annihilation. And, you know, the first couple of days, we were seeing a lot of isolated injuries, head or chest or abdomen. But today, it's reported that tanks have been used at the food distribution centers, which makes sense because we're seeing multi-trauma. We're seeing head, neck, chest, abdomen, extremities, many, many deaths. And it just doesn't have to be this way. You know, this is something that's just got to stop.
In Geneva, a group of UN experts told the UN Human Rights Council Israel is committing war crimes and the crime against humanity of extermination. This is former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay.
These attacks were part of a widespread and relentless assault against the Palestinian people, in which Israeli forces have committed war crimes, including directing attacks against civilians and willful killing, and the crime against humanity of extermination. The goal of the Israeli government is abundantly clear: the destruction of life in Gaza.
Here in New York, ICE agents arrested New York City Comptroller Brad Lander Tuesday as he was escorting a man at an immigration courthouse in Lower Manhattan. Lander, who was running for mayor, was handcuffed and detained by agents after he demanded to see a judicial warrant as agents tried to detain the man he was accompanying.
Stop that. You don't have authority to arrest U.S. citizens.
Sir,
you don't have the authority to arrest U.S. citizens.
Please say that.
You don't have the, I'm not obstructing. I'm standing right here in the hallway. I asked to see the judicial warrant. By asking for a judicial warrant? You don't have the authority to arrest U.S. citizens asking for a judicial warrant.
Brad Lander was held for several hours in the latest confrontation between Democratic politicians and federal immigration agents. Other mayoral candidates denounced Lander's arrest. New York State Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani wrote, "This is fascism." And former Governor Andrew Cuomo said the arrest is an example of the, quote, extreme thuggery of Trump's ICE out of control. City Comptroller Brad Lander will join us later in the hour. On Capitol Hill, California, Democratic Senator Alex Padilla took to the Senate floor Tuesday to recount how federal agents shoved him into a hallway floor and handcuffed him last week when he attempted to ask a question during a press conference held by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem.
I was pushed and pulled, struggled to maintain my balance. I was forced to the ground, first on my knees, and then flat on my chest. And as I was handcuffed and marched down a hallway, if that is what the administration is willing to do to a United States senator for having the authority to simply ask a question, imagine what they'll do to any American who dares to speak up.
ICE agents are continuing to carry out raids around Los Angeles. On Wednesday, protests broke out in Pico Rivera after masked armed agents raided multiple locations in the city, including a Walmart. They detained a number of people, including at least one U.S. citizen. Video showed ICE agents cocking assault rifles and pointing them at civilians. 10 Democratic lawmakers are seeking more information about how the tech company Palantir is helping the Trump administration build what the lawmakers described as a government-wide searchable mega database that connects sensitive tax and other government data. In a letter to Palantir CEO Alex Karp, the lawmakers described the database as a, quote, surveillance nightmare that, quote, will make it significantly easier for Donald Trump's administration to spy on and target his growing list of enemies and other Americans, unquote. A federal judge in Boston's ruled the Trump administration must restore more than $1 billion in grants cut by the National Institutes of Health as part of a White House effort to end research linked to diversity, equity, or inclusion or gender ideology. U.S. District Judge William Young, who was appointed by President Reagan, said, quote, this represents racial discrimination and discrimination against America's LGBTQ community. Young went on to say, quote, I've sat on this bench now for 40 years. I've never seen government racial discrimination like this, the judge said. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans are pushing for sweeping cuts to Medicaid and to stricter work requirements for Medicaid recipients. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer warned the Republican Senate proposal will be deeper and more devastating than the cuts already by the House. He wrote online, quote, this could lead to even more than the 16 million people expected to lose health insurance and hundreds of hospitals and health centers facing higher risk of closure. CNN reports the Environmental Protection Agency has directed staff overseeing the states in the Midwest to stop enforcing violations by the fossil fuel industry. The move is in line with EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin's pledge to orchestrate the largest deregulation action in U.S. history. EPA staff overseeing southern states, including Texas, Louisiana, and New Mexico, have also effectively halted enforcement actions against polluting companies. In Memphis, Tennessee, the NAACP has announced plans to sue Elon Musk's artificial intelligence firm xAI for violating the Clean Air Act by running a massive data center near a historically black neighborhood without legal permits. Musk's facility runs on 35 methane gas-powered turbine generators, which emit significant amounts of nitrogen oxide and other toxic chemicals. NAACP President Eric Johnson said, quote, we cannot afford to normalize this kind of environmental injustice, where billion-dollar companies set up polluting operations in black neighborhoods without any permits and think they'll get away with it because the people don't have the power to fight back, unquote. To see our coverage of this issue, go to democracynow.org. In other environmental news, a new report has revealed the world's largest banks committed nearly $900 billion last year to finance coal, oil, and gas projects. That's a 23% increase over the previous year. Altogether, the world's largest 65 banks have committed $7.9 trillion to the fossil fuel industry since the Paris climate deal was reached a decade ago. In Georgia, a woman who was declared brain dead nearly 4 months ago has given birth to a baby boy via emergency C-section. Doctors had kept the mother, Adriana Smith, on life support against the wishes of her distraught family. Her body was kept on life support due to the state's near total abortion ban. Adriana Smith's mother has described the months-long ordeal as torture. Adriana was scheduled to be taken off life support Tuesday. And Saudi Arabia has executed the prominent journalist Turki Alcaser, who was arrested in 2018 and convicted on what press freedom advocates say are trumped-up charges. The Committee to Protect Journalists said, quote, the international community's failure to deliver justice for Jamal Khashoggi did not just betray one journalist. It emboldened de facto ruler Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to continue his persecution of the press, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Iran. In a televised address, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has rejected President Trump's calls for unconditional surrender and warned Iran will meet any U.S. military action in Iran with, quote, irreparable harm. Trump's directly threatened Khamenei by writing on Truth Social that the U.S. knows where he is, adding, quote, we are not going to take him out, at least not for now. This comes as multiple reports indicate Trump is moving closer to ordering U.S. airstrikes on Iran. On Tuesday, he dismissed findings on Iran by his own intelligence agencies. In March, the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, told lawmakers the intelligence community, quote, continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, unquote. On Tuesday, Trump dismissed Gabbard's testimony when asked about it by reporters.
Tulsi Gabbard testified in March that the intelligence community said Iran wasn't building a nuclear weapon.
I don't care what she said. I think they were very close to having it.
This all comes as Israel's continuing to attack Iran for a sixth day, forcing thousands of people to flee Tehran. More than 50 Israeli warplanes struck targets inside Iran in the early hours of today. Iran responded by firing ballistic missiles and launching drones at Israel. According to one count, Israeli strikes since Friday have killed at least 585 people across Iran and wounded over 1,300 others. Iranian strikes on Israel have killed at least 23 people and injured over 630. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine called for his colleagues to support his war powers resolution to prevent a U.S. war with Iran.
I happen to believe that the United States engaging in a war against Iran, a third war in the Middle East since 2001, would be a catastrophic blunder for this country.
Meanwhile, there's a growing split within Trump's MAGA coalition over the prospect of the U.S. attacking Iran. Conservative TV host Tucker Carlson has railed against what he's called warmongers within the Republican Party. On Tuesday, video went viral of him interviewing the hawkish Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
If you don't know anything about the country...
I didn't say I don't know anything about
the country. What's the ethnic mix of Iran?
They are Persians and predominantly Shia. Okay,
You don't know anything about Iran. So,
okay,
actually,
I am not the Tucker Carlson expert on Iran.
You're a senator who's calling for the overthrow of the government.
You're the one who
knows anything about the country.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Akbar Shahid Ahmed is the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, where his latest pieces are headlined, Israel's War on Iran Bears the Echo of Past American Mistakes. And another article, the pro-Israel U.S. general quietly influencing Trump on Iran. But we begin in Tehran with Mohammad Marandi, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran, part of the nuclear deal negotiations in 2015. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Mohammad Marandi, let's begin with you. You're in the capital of Iran, in Tehran, the capital that where President Trump has said everyone should leave. Can you talk about what's happening? Describe the scene on the ground. How are people dealing?
Well, the administration here has facilitated people leaving Tehran since a few days ago. Many government agencies are now allowing people to work from home or to take vacation. And university and school exams have been canceled for now so that those who want to leave city can do so. So Trump's warning, which is an act of terror, really didn't have a huge impact. Many people had already left. People like myself are here in Tehran. Actually, I'm in the Iranian National Television and Radio buildings, and one of the buildings that's been evacuated. I'm here because the internet is a bit better, is better than outside. And as you know, the day before yesterday, they bombed the Iranian radio and television network and murdered a number of journalists.
And Professor, we have all these reports of the targeted killings or assassinations of key leaders and scientists in Iran. To what degree do you feel that this terror campaign of Israel has destabilized Iran's top leadership?
Actually, these terror attacks have united the country more than ever before, or at least since in my opinion, when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. Those assassinations were carried out during the first hours of this unprovoked attack, and they bombed apartment blocks to get people. They, for example, in one apartment block where they were seeking to murder one or two high-ranking military officials, they killed everyone, 65 people, including over 20 children. So that was not, and Western media tries to celebrate this and to show how sophisticated such an attack is. It's not sophisticated. My neighbors know where I am. Their neighbors know they live there. There's nothing sophisticated about slaughtering everyone in a building, in an apartment building, to murder one or two people. But that's, of course, what the Israeli regime has done across the board. They destroy apartment blocks in Beirut. And, of course, Western media would call these Hezbollah targets in order to hide the crimes. And we've seen what they've been doing in Gaza for 21 months, this genocide, this Holocaust, where they're slaughtering everyone everywhere. So we shouldn't have any expectations for the Israeli regime to behave any different towards Iranians, because for them, we are all Amalek.
And also, I noticed that in the last day or so, the Iranian government has urged its people to delete social media platforms like WhatsApp and Instagram. The government claims that these platforms are relaying information to Israel, geolocation information about individual Iranians. This prospect of these media companies or actually participating or colluding with Israel, what's your sense of that?
Yes, Meta is actively participating in the attacks on Iran. They are giving locations for academics, university professors. I, too, unfortunately, have WhatsApp. I do not have Instagram. My account was deleted by Instagram a long time ago. But I only have WhatsApp because many journalists are trying to contact me, and I don't have any other means but to stay in contact with some of these people. And, of course, people have asked me to give up my cell phone. But again, I have no option, because if I do, then I cannot conduct interviews. So I have to take this risk. But others are being encouraged to delete Instagram and to delete WhatsApp. And I encourage people across the world to do so as well.
I wanted to get your response, Mohammad Mirandi, to first the Iran Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, rejecting Trump's calls for unconditional surrender, warning that Iran will meet any U.S. military action in Iran with irreparable harm, the significance of him speaking out, and of Trump directly threatening him. We followed this over a few days. Trump has gone back and forth, U.S. officials saying that he stopped Netanyahu from targeting Ali Khamenei, but then threatening Ali Khamenei himself, and ultimately, most recently, writing, "We are not going to take him out, at least not for now." Can you talk about the significance of all of this and the U.S. Fleet moving closer to the Middle East, and Trump now apparently moving closer to getting directly involved, the whole issue of whether the U.S. would use something that they haven't yet given to Israel, which is a bunker buster bomb in Fordo?
Well, Trump and Netanyahu are two sides of the same coin. They are both genocidal, and they have no red lines. And the Iranians, of course, will ignore their threats and continue to defend the country's sovereignty against this unprovoked aggression and this war that's been imposed upon us. The Iranians have said very clearly that if the United States attacks, Iran will punish it severely. And Iran's underground drone and missile bases across the Persian Gulf region and the Indian Ocean are prepared for war. And I think those tiny Arab dictatorships in the Persian Gulf that have oil and gas installations, those that host American bases, and all of them do, if there is war, they these regimes will be swept away because those bases are on their territory, and ordinary Iranians believe that they are fully complicit in any aggression against Iran. So in case of any act of war against Iran by the United States, I think that that will be catastrophic for the global economy. It will bring about a Great Depression, worse than the 1930s in the United States.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. Akbar, your reaction to the events of the last couple of days in this Israeli attack on Iran?
I think while we're seeing a really tremendous risk, as Dr. Morandi is saying, of the U.S. being pulled in, and we have to remember that in addition to, you know, the bases, the U.S. partners, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, which are all major energy exporters, maybe not to the U.S., but to the global economy, to Europe, to China, to Asia. Beyond that, there are 40,000 U.S. troops, right? Many of them in Iraq, many across the region. Donald Trump, while saying that he was a peace through strength, anti-war president, we haven't seen him solve any of the wars that he said he would address, Ukraine, Gaza. In fact, now there's a new war unfolding on his watch, and he hasn't brought back any of these military deployments. What this tells us, really, is that because he's A, kind of crippled the federal government, he's undermined the State Department, there's chaos at the top ranks of the Pentagon, there isn't even capacity in the Trump administration to de-escalate at this point, and B, Trump didn't really have a clear strategic doctrine, right? For Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the goal of an attack on Iran, and frankly, a joint U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, that's been a long-standing goal. He's wanted that for decades. Netanyahu, through the Biden administration, before Trump entered office, was able to amass more and more American support. And I think he looked at this and said, this is my moment. Trump can't stop me. I've had a clear goal. And so I think that's where we're at a moment of immense danger. The only kind of restraining, de-escalatory force could really be the U.S. You have regional governments, Saudi Arabia among them, the Qataris, Oman, which has hosted talks between the U.S. and Iran. All these regional governments are trying to de-escalate. But what I hear from Arab diplomats is, while the Trump administration is issuing statements to them, even behind the scenes, saying, no, no, don't worry, we're not going to get the U.S. involved, there's a clear gap between that rhetoric, which matches Trump's, again, peace through strength, anti-war claims, and Trump's actual actions, which are indicating a very clear U.S. military buildup and an increasing likelihood of a hugely devastating U.S. war with Iran.
Akbar, if you can talk about this latest piece, Israel's war on Iran, the latest piece that you wrote, on who is got Trump's ear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Amy, it's really interesting, right? This is a team where the president has made personal fealty, personal loyalty, the main qualifying factor, right? You've seen him reject intelligence, saying that Iran was not rushing towards a nuclear weapon. You've seen him devastate the State Department. You've seen him fire top military commanders, which means that the people around him are either really cowed or very weak or thinking about their own careers. Into that gap, the person that steps in and who I highlighted in this recent piece is someone called Eric Kurilla. That's the top U.S. military commander in the Middle East. He's a four-star army general. He's been in his position since 2022. And what was striking as I got to understand Kurilla's deep influence over Trump was a couple of things. He's, even by the standards of American officials who work really closely with Israeli counterparts all the time, Kurilla is seen as extremely close. One former U.S. official told me, in internal deliberations, Kurilla often seemed to know what the Israelis were thinking and what intelligence they had before any other person in the American government. So there's that level of familiarity. He was in position under Biden, which was a period during which he worked really closely with the Israelis in the wars in Gaza, in Lebanon, and in Israel's defense, right, against Iranian barrages, which it did face in 2024. In that period, he began kind of joint planning with the Israelis for a U.S.-Israeli strike, and now it looks like the moment is ripe. And there's another just confluence of factors that increase the danger here. Kurilla is looking at his retirement date in the coming months, maybe even as soon as July. And the chatter among American and Israeli officials for a while has been, we want to get this joint U.S.-Israeli campaign against Iran done while Kurilla is in office. So all these factors have come together. And we have to remember that's happening under, again, a President Donald Trump, who, as one expert told me, looks at stars and badges, and he can't say no, right? He hero worships the military. He sees it as a kind of expression of masculinity, of strength, of all these dynamics he's obsessed with. So is Donald Trump really going to tell a general, even one who, you know, necessarily, Kurilla is not necessarily, Tucker Carlson's talked about warmongers. I think Kurilla and other military leaders would say we're very much thinking about the U.S.'s best interests, but military leaders are battlefield leaders. They are not necessarily strategists for long-term stability, nor are they politicians who can win public support. When the American public has shown they are very war-wary, and when it's not clear how a U.S.-Israeli strike would lead to a better strategic long-term picture instead of unpredictable chaos and violence, do we really want a military leader to be the most influential voice in Trump's ear? That's where we are right now with General Kurilla.
And Akbar, I wanted to ask you, the Israeli government, the officials have kept claiming that they're not interested in regime change in Iran. But yet this week, the Jerusalem Post has an article about the eldest son of the late Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, talking about how he has a 100-day transition plan and that he will soon be back in Iran. Your thoughts on how the impact of this kind of news on the Iranian people?
It's impossible to separate headlines like that from the last 22 years of U.S. foreign policy in the region, right? People hear that and they think about regime change in Iraq, which led to chaos and the rise of ISIS. They hear that, they think about Libya, which again, chaotic, horrible human trafficking situation. So I think the way that this is resonating for Iranians, I imagine, and also certainly for Americans and audiences around the world is, this is just so fantastical, right? And Israeli officials, to your point, have said two things at once. They have said, we're not pursuing regime change. Our goal is to limit Iran's nuclear development. But we've also seen Israeli officials across the board, importantly, not just Netanyahu, but the leading opposition figures, political rivals of Netanyahu, really senior Israeli political figures have come out and said, you know, we're not necessarily doing regime change, but Iranian people, don't you think this is a great time to have a revolution? You know, and I think that kind of, there's a lot in there that's concerning, right? I think for Iranian activists who have been raising their voices and been really viciously repressed for it, they feel that their message, their calls for reform are being hijacked in a way by Netanyahu, who is deeply unpopular there. And I just think it's very unlikely to work, right? There's not there's not an indication throughout history, and certainly not in recent Middle Eastern history, that suggests local communities under bombing are going to say, absolutely, the people bombing us are the liberators. This is who we want to stand with. With regard to Reza Pahlavi and this idea of restoring the monarchy in Iran, Pahlavi lives here in D.C. He's very much a fixture in kind of hawkish circles, close to people here. But the kind of magical thinking that you're seeing among D.C. policymakers, where they believe that someone who's been out of Iran since 1979 is going to go in and understand the modern country where most people are young, where most people have not ever lived under Shah, it's just remarkable and stunning, right? And you mentioned earlier in the show these congressional efforts that Senator Kaine is leading, some legislators in the House are leading. And I do think there's a significant number of Democrats who are willing to stand up and question whether another clear attempt at regime change or certainly a risk of mission creep is worth it. But you aren't seeing Republicans sign on. Only one Republican member of Congress so far has joined those resolutions. And that tells us a lot about the disconnect between the really, again, magical thinking, hawkish thinking in decision-making and policy circles here in Washington and people in America, people in Iran, people around the world.
Akbar Ashahed Ahmed, we want to thank you for being with us, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. His recent pieces, we'll link to at democracynow.org. Israel's war in Iran bears the echo of past American mistakes, and the pro-Israel U.S. general quietly influencing Trump on Iran, speaking to us from D.C. Mohammed Brandi, thank you as well, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran, part of the nuclear deal negotiations of 2015. When we come back, what's happening in Gaza as the world's attention turns to Iran? Then we'll be joined by New York City Comptroller Brad Lander, arrested by ICE yesterday as he tried to protect an immigrant in court. Stay with us. Performing in our Democracy Now! Studio yesterday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Gaza, where the death toll from an Israeli attack on aid seekers in Khan Yunis Tuesday has reached 70. Hundreds of Palestinians were also wounded. Israeli forces attacked using tanks, drones, machine guns on crowds gathered hoping to receive bags of flour. A spokesperson for the Gaza Civil Defense said, quote, Israeli drones fired at the citizens. Some minutes later, Israeli tanks fired several shells at the citizens, which led to a large number of martyrs and wounded, unquote. This is Dr. Mark Brunner, a doctor from Oregon who's volunteering at the Nasser Hospital.
Every time we know that there's a few so-called food distribution, we know that there's going to be annihilation. And, you know, the first couple of days, we were seeing a lot of isolated injuries, head or chest or abdomen. But today, it's reported that tanks have been used at the food distribution centers, which makes sense because we're seeing multi-trauma. We're seeing head, neck, chest, abdomen, extremities, many, many deaths. And it just doesn't have to be this way. You know, this is something that's just got to stop.
This comes as a group of UN experts in Geneva told the UN Human Rights Council Israel's committing war crimes and the crime against humanity of extermination. For more, we're joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, the Palestinian author Mousab Abu Toha. His latest piece is headlined, What Gaza Needs Now, in the New Yorker magazine. Mousab joins us from Syracuse, New York, where he has moved from Gaza with his family. Mousab, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your latest piece is devastating. You write, my family is starving. My neighbors are dying. I'm compelled to share these injustices because they need to stop. Tell us about your constant conversations with people in Gaza, some soon after die, and what you're calling for now.
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me again. Thank you so much, Democracy Now!, for amplifying the stories that do not, unfortunately, get to be heard by mainstream media. As I said in my piece, the aim of writing these stories and sharing them with the outside world, because, you know, there was a full internet blackout for the past few days. It was fixed, and now it's again not working. So the hope of sharing the news and sharing stories is that these stories will not happen again and again. And just a few hours after I published the piece, there was another massacre of aid seekers, whether in North Gaza or in the middle of the Gaza Strip or in Rafah. If we're going to talk about, you know, the trouble of or the risk of going to get aid, yesterday there was a massacre, a huge massacre on the Rashid Street on the beach of Gaza City. More than 60 people were killed while trying to get aid from the trucks that were entering from Israel. that these 60s were just part of the 100 people who were killed only yesterday. This morning, I want to tell you what happened today, local time in Gaza, after 3 a.m. Now in Gaza, it is 4 or 3 a.m. So since 3 a.m., Israel bombed a tent in Khan Yunis at 3 a.m. Five people were killed. Three of them were from one same family, a father and his two children. And then there were early reports that Israel was targeting Palestinians who were seeking aid near the Netzarim distribution. They call it distribution site. 11 people were killed. These are confirmed people who were killed, and 70 people were wounded. And then there was an airstrike on a tent in Khan Yunis, in Mawasi Khan Yunis, so-called humanitarian zone or non-combat zone. Six people were killed. And then there was another airstrike, and this is devastating. We just got the names. There was an airstrike on a house in Al Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. Eight people were killed. Of them, there were seven children. And I just posted their names, if you allow me to read the names of these kids. Their names are Zaid, Bisan, Muhammad, Asil, Sama, Lama, Saad. So these are seven kids from Mansour family who were killed today morning at 3 a.m. local time. And then as we were talking, there are reports that three people were killed near the aid site in Rafah. And just an hour ago, three people were killed near the Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City, close to the Shurafa roundabout. So I just read to you the news of what has been happening in Gaza in the past, less than 12 hours, in the past 12 hours. So people continue to starve, and there are lots of lying that I hear on the news, that Israel distributed, or this so-called humanitarian foundation, distributed 13 million meals. These are big lies. What meals? I mean, my family in Gaza, they have never received any meal. My wife's family never received any meals. I don't know where they bring these numbers. I don't know how they come up with these numbers. But these are not true at all. People have to go to the so-called distribution site. And they know they will be killed. And many people, when I post the videos or news of people getting killed while trying to get aid, they tell me, Mus'ab, tell them not to go. It's like, you know what? It's like, you know, when COVID hit and people knew that there is a dangerous virus, and as if you're asking, no, don't go out, don't go to buy things, don't go shopping, don't go visit, don't go to the hospital because there is COVID outside. People will not stop going out to get food for themselves and for their children, even though they know first they will be killed, and they know that they will not necessarily get fooded because it's very, very small amount of food that is getting in.
And Mossab, I wanted to ask you also the fear that among Palestinians that now that Israel has launched this war on Iran, that the rest of the world will shift its focus and forget about what is happening in Gaza, and that some people believe that this is precisely part of the plan of Netanyahu because Israel has been so discredited internationally by its attacks in Gaza. Your sense, are the Palestinians being forgotten at this moment?
You know what? I mean, first of all, people thought that, unfortunately, when Israel attacked Iran during the night, people thought that in some way that the focus of the Israeli airstrikes would be less because they are going to move their troops or move their F-16, their death warplanes, somewhere else, although we don't wish anyone else in the world to be killed, right? So people thought that this would result in less pressure, less death in Gaza. But this is not what we have seen. Unfortunately, this is not a war in Gaza. It's a genocide that is happening while Israel is targeting everything, people seeking aid, people who are trying to get to the hospital, and people who do not find medicine to heal, do not have healthy food to heal. So people thought that this in some way would change the focus of this Israeli genocide somewhere else without necessarily resulting in the death of so many people in other places. But what we are watching right now is that Israel intensified its airstrikes. Yesterday, they killed about more than 100 people, 60 of them, as I mentioned, while seeking aid in Beit Lahia and Rafah in Nusayrat, middle of Gaza. And today morning, just in the past 12 hours, Israel killed more than 40 people. So it's not like people in Gaza want people to move its killing machine somewhere else. But Israel is not letting anyone survive. Not in Gaza, not in Iran, not in Syria, not in Lebanon. They continue to kill in so many places. And they say, oh, we are attacked by so many people. And everyone wants us to disappear from the map. As if they are not disappearing, us Palestinians in Gaza. If you look at the what they call evacuation orders or evacuation warnings. Yesterday, 5 days ago, they posted a general photo map of Gaza, and they marked the areas that are called combat zones in red. And it was about 70% of the Gaza Strip. One day after that, they added one more square of red into the map. So they expanded the so-called combat zone. Yesterday, they added more red areas, which means that this area should be evacuated. And so Israel is expanding their combat zone, which is one way or another, they are occupying this area militarily. And the more dangerous thing is not that they are marking these areas as combat zones. They are telling everyone, and this is in Arabic, they say, returning to this area would put your life at risk. So they are telling people that, okay, we are gonna tell you that this area is combat zone, and you are not allowed to return to it. They don't tell you that, okay, this is a combat zone for a month, for a week, for 2 weeks, or for a year. No, it is indefinitely a combat zone. If you go back there and we ask them, oh, why did you kill this guy? They say, oh, he returned to a combat zone. Even though this guy or that family returned not to live because there's
Masav,
no life
there. We have 30 seconds.
They just wanted to return to find something that they left because they couldn't carry everything, whether it's clothes, whether it's shoes, whether it's... I don't know. This is devastating. Israel is committing these war crimes live, and we are posting about them. We are publishing the names of these children who are killed, and no one cares.
Masav Abu Toha, Pulitzer Prize-winning Palestinian poet and author, will link to your piece in The New Yorker, What Gaza Needs Now. My family is starving. My neighbors are dying. I'm compelled to share these injustices because they need to stop. When we come back, another public official has been arrested by ICE. We'll speak to New York City Comptroller Brad Lander. Stay with us.
Je dar mangat kukre Mehli khasam sune Jano jo Na poochho chaati Jano jo Na poochho chaati Aage jaata na hai
Jano Jot by Sunny Singh, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio yesterday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. ICE agents arrested the New York City Comptroller, Brad Lander, yesterday as he was escorting a family out of immigration court in Lower Manhattan. Lander is running for mayor. He was handcuffed and detained by masked agents after he demanded to see a judicial warrant from agents trying to detain the man he was accompanying.
You have a judicial warrant. You have a judicial warrant. Had I seen the judicial warrant? Had I seen the warrant? I will let go when you show me the judicial warrant. Where is it?
I have my hand here.
You're obstructing.
You're obstructing.
I would like to see the warrant.
You don't have authority to arrest U.S. citizens.
Sir,
you don't have the authority to arrest U.S. citizens. You don't have to. I'm not obstructing. I'm standing right here in the hallway. I asked to see the judicial warrant. By asking for a judicial warrant? You don't have the authority to arrest U.S. citizens asking for a judicial warrant.
City Controller Brad Lander was held for several hours before being released when the New York governor came down to demand this. She had said what had happened was bull, and she used the whole thing. He exited the courthouse building accompanied by his wife, as well as Governor Kathy Hochul. He spoke to supporters gathered outside the arrest and the man he was attempting to escort, who he named Edgardo.
I certainly did not assault an officer. I engaged anyway. But I guess I just think here's the thing. Like, I know I will have due process and I will have a good lawyer and my rights will be protected. But Edgardo has no due process rights and no lawyer and is going to sleep tonight in God knows where in an ICE detention facility. My goal was to walk Edgardo out of the building. I can't tell you we got to walk one family out today, and that's this family of four that's back at home, and nothing would have made me happier to be able to get in that elevator and let Edgardo go about his business. That was what I came to do, and it is all I want.
For more, we're joined in studio by the controller of the city of New York, Brad Lander. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Interviewed you when you were at a protest calling for the release of Mohsen Mahdawi, Columbia student who was arrested in Vermont. Talk about what happened yesterday. Yeah.
I've been going down to immigration court now for the last 3 weeks since Department of Homeland Security made this change and started basically stripping people of their status. It's called dismissing their cases, which sounds good, except as soon as it happens, you're subject to expedited removal. And so
they say the case is dismissed, the judge says that, and then ICE agents meet you at the door and arrest you?
It's even a little worse than that. You know, you think in the courtroom maybe this is good. People don't understand what's happening. The person before Edgardo's a person named Zed who speaks Yoruba, but the only translator they had for him was in French. And the judge asked, do you understand what's happening? And of course he said no. So your case is dismissed, you're stripped of status, you walk out of the courtroom, you walk down the hallway, and then those masked ICE agents are waiting in the elevator lobby to grab you. And so what I had done with, you know, five families previously or individuals is just meet them either in the courtroom or just outside it and just try to escort them down the hallway into the elevator and out of the building. And five times previously, including once yesterday, my wife and I were able to do that. And this family that was worried they were going to get deported, they only have one more week, but at least they have a chance to come back to court and present their case. But then in this case, as I was asking to see the judicial warrant, they just grabbed him up.
But don't you have a police escort of security? So you have police versus ICE now?
The previous time, so, you know, being controller, I'm a citywide elected official. It comes with an NYPD detail. The previous times, the officer accompanied me and the, you know, whatever the family or individual that I was walking with, this couple, Maria and Manuel, a father named Camilo and his son, Brian. And I thought, great, here's the NYPD joining the controller to escort these asylum seekers out of the building to help them get due process and safety. In this case, obviously, that did not matter. And look, I think what's happening here. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, and Brad, it's been a while since we talked, but I wanted to ask you, you kept saying to the ICE agents, where's your judicial warrant? However, ICE is claiming that this was a public space and they didn't need a judicial warrant. What's your understanding?
I mean, I'll leave this for the lawyers. I am not an immigration lawyer. What people have been instructed to ask, and that, you know, is I need to see a judicial warrant. And we're trying to get good information to these families. What New York City should be doing is connecting people to lawyers and attorneys. And, you know, and we've got a mayor here, Eric Adams, who sold New Yorkers out to Donald Trump and is failing to get people the information they need. We could be talking to immigrant families in the schools, in the shelters, in the public hospital system. But yes, asking for a judicial warrant is a good idea for people to do. Having a lawyer is even better. And look, if they do proceed to charges here, I know I'll have one. Edgardo doesn't have one. Zed doesn't have one. Thousands of people just trying to seek asylum don't have lawyers or due process rights. And that is the tragedy right now.
And this trend now throughout the country of federal agents basically roughing up and detaining or arresting elected officials, Roz Baraka, the mayor of Newark, and a congresswoman there in California, a U.S. Senator, Alex Padilla, and now this situation with you?
Yes, I mean, and Pam Bondi was very clear. They're trying to wreak havoc in cities. They say to liberate Democratic cities from their duly elected officials. This is part of what authoritarians do, strike fear into immigrant families and communities and try to undermine the rule of law and basic democracy by stoking conflict. And that is what they're doing. Our challenge is to find a way to stand up for the rule of law, for due process, for people's rights, and to do it in a way that is nonviolent and insistent, demands it, but also doesn't help them escalate conflict.
Let me ask you something. There was a rally as you were being held inside, and your wife, who's a lawyer, she also spoke. She wasn't taken like you were. Mayor Adams sent police to break up that rally. Did he ever support you? I mean, you had Zoran Mamdani there speaking out. He's your competitor. He is running for mayor as well. You had Adrian Adams. Even Andrew Cuomo spoke out for you. Michael Blake. But what about the mayor?
Five mayoral candidates showed up, and I'm grateful to every one of them, including Zoran Mamdani, who I've cross-endorsed. Andrew Cuomo did not show up, but at least he issued a statement saying that my arrest was wrong. Eric Adams, who has sold this city out to Donald Trump to try to get his own pardon, let's be clear, like it's only himself he cares about, and he is putting New York's immigrants in harm's way. So no, he did not call me, he didn't do anything to help, and issued a just rude statement.
I wanted to go to that co-endorsement because we want to get to ranked choice voting. It is not known to most people in this country what it is, but we're going to go to a clip right now of the two of you, Zoran Mamdani and Brad, and you, Brad Lander, endorsing each other. What this means, you're both running for mayor.
We both love New York City.
And that's why it's so important to not send scandal-ridden, corrupt Andrew Cuomo to City Hall.
New Yorkers deserve so much better than a disgraced creep.
Agreed.
Zoran, you've done a remarkable job building a historic grassroots campaign for a New York City all New Yorkers can afford.
Brad, you've been a principled progressive leader in our city for years.
Early voting starts tomorrow, and we both know what we need to do to save our city from Andrew Cuomo.
You want to tell him?
You go first.
Nah, you go first.
Let's do it together. We're cross-endorsing.
In New York City, we have ranked choice voting. That means you can rank up to five candidates for mayor.
Brad and I are officially telling our supporters.
Rank me number one.
Rank Zoran number two.
Let's send Andrew Cuomo
back to the suburbs.
So there you have a very confusing ad. You're both running for mayor. Explain ranked choice voting and what this means.
Ranked choice voting, instead of just getting one candidate, you can rank your preferences up to five. Here's my number one candidate, my number two candidate. So we're encouraging people, rank me number one, rank Zoran Mamdani number two. Don't rank Andrew Cuomo anywhere. And that way our votes would get combined, and whichever of us is ahead will face Andrew Cuomo with all of the combined votes. Most New Yorkers don't want him to be mayor, and ranked choice voting can help make sure that
in this last 20 seconds, New York for All Act, can you explain what it is, why you're supporting it?
New York City is a sanctuary city, but New York State needs to do more to protect immigrants, not to allow collaboration with ICE, and to provide more legal representation to people like Edgardo.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Brad Lander, New York City controller, Democratic mayoral candidate. ICE agents arrested him Tuesday for escorting a man out of his immigration hearing yesterday. That does it for our show. We have job openings, senior headline news director, director of audience. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hey, Kingston families, looking for an unforgettable summer adventure for your kids? Look no further than Assas Camps right on Queens.